Hello and welcome to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast. Each week, we talk about different college admissions topics and answer those tough questions you may be dealing with concerning getting into the college of your choice. We know how difficult this process can be, so each week, we try and make it easier to navigate. Now, here's your host, Anna Wren and Mark Huffer.
Greetings and welcome to Coast College Admissions Podcast. Number 274. I'm kidding. We are talking about acceptance letters. My name is Mark Huffer, and I'm here with my co-host,
Anna Wren.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
Good. How are you, Mark?
Well, I'm really good. It is one of those continuing pointed times in the college application process season. We are having students who are getting those wonderful letters of joy and possibly those other letters of less joy. I think those of us who work with students in this process, this is the time we get the extremes on both sides. And we have those communications with students who are elated and those who are not quite as elated.
Correct. And, you know, the benefit, I think, of it coming out, because a lot of decisions do come out right around Christmas break or holidays, is that you can take a vacation and forget it. But, you know, when decisions come out in January, it might be a little harder to do that. But I think it's important to kind of make sense of these acceptance letters, though, or these offer letters, because I know I've had students that have sent me something and said, I don't understand. Did I get in?
Exactly. I mean, you read through it and it's hard to tell. Most colleges make it really apparent in the first line, but there are some you have to almost filter and weave through until you figure out whether they want you to come in September or not.
And, you know, at the same time, like for the ones that might have deferred or some other in between or a wait list, that is also sometimes harder to decipher as well. But today, I think we're going to focus on if you get the amazing I got in letter, right?
Absolutely. I think that's the happy dance letter, the one that, you know, you start singing and ask for the, you know, the rainbows to unleash their happiness on you. And that's when they start calling everybody and telling them that they got in. But I think we are going to talk a little bit more about not only the get in, but also what the rest of the letter is.
Yes, absolutely. And go into detail on that. So let's first talk about, because I had a student actually ask me, how do I find out my decision? So I would like to say now in this day and age, it wasn't like it was back then. We used to get like those big packages in the mail and know we got in, would dread that thin envelope. But nowadays, it's all, most of it is electronic. So you can either find out via email, checking your portal, which has become really popular, and or getting a package in the mail, or actually some combination of the above.
Right. I've actually, that's one of the things I think colleges are still in that no man's land between, you know, the history and the tradition of sending out a letter and a hard copy and opening it up. And I think because there are a lot of old people who run admissions departments, we kind of have that tie to tradition, and we kind of, you know, think that that's the way that people should hear about it. But I think also there are more and more people who are expecting that electronic version of communication. And so some schools do both, some schools only do one. And it's interesting to hear a student's reaction to both of those different kinds of communication.
That's true. And now I know some even have like videos embedded in the emails. But, you know, the only one I think you need to keep on top of is just the ones that say that the notification will be in the portal. So just remember to check access to your portals if you're expecting a decision.
Exactly. That's the one thing I think that has changed over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years specifically, is how students have to stay on top of deadlines and stay on top of where they need to get information. And that's one of the critical parts. If you don't know about an acceptance or you don't know about a rejection, and do things that you would not have otherwise, if you don't know about it, you have to check in. You have to make sure that you're on top of those kind of communications.
Great. So now that we know how to find out your status, let's talk about what's in an acceptance letter. What can students expect to see, Mark?
Well, the first thing, and like we mentioned, the first line is usually an indicator of, you know, whether you can celebrate or wait for the next letter to celebrate. And that's usually, it will, you know, specifically say, we are delighted to have you come join us, or we have determined, and either one of those, you know, kind of set the tone. What are the common ones that you hear?
Usually, unfortunately, we do not have enough, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, I think it's a soft letdown usually, or just the congratulations. We're really excited to welcome you to blah, blah, blah class.
Yeah. Whenever you see the word regrettably, I think that's the one.
Yes.
That's definitely not a letter that's headed in the direction you probably want. So.
But let's talk about the happy dance one. So what additional information will they get?
Well, further along the letter, they're going to run into a lot of the specifics that are tied to accepting the offer letter. But as you mentioned, you know, there are different types of applications, like you said. Some people already know their early decision or early action. And I think it's probably important we talk about the difference between early decision letters that come in with with acceptances and early action. How about what kind of things do you tell students who are applying in those fashions?
So if it's early decision, usually they will ask for a deposit. And since you've already committed to them, you have to send out that check. It might seem like a lot of money, but it is just a fraction. And, you know, I think, you know, for the early decision, you do have to send that out sooner rather than later because your spot is confirmed. Whereas early action, I feel like that always gets a little confusing for students because they still encourage you to send in your deposit and make a decision as soon as possible. And I think what's worse is nowadays, my students and parents will get letters that say, have you made a decision? Are you leaning towards really likely, maybe likely, not so likely? And it's to help them plan, or they might say, oh, you know, if you respond by this time, you know, there's like some money incentive, like scholarships attached to it too. But I think the important thing to remind students is there is something called the National College Decision Day, which is May 1st. And so in most cases, you should not have to make a decision until then.
Exactly. And I think that's one thing that students need to know. If they've done early decision, and you and I have talked about this in other podcasts, if you go early decision and you get accepted, it's a legal binding contract. And basically you are going to that school and you are going to accept whatever kind of financial aid that they are providing. And that pretty much your work is done. You can celebrate, pack up your goldfish and get ready to go in September. But with early action, there are lots of different little tiny components of it that I think students, like you say, once they get that letter and it says, please send in the deposit, they don't realize sometimes, unless that they've been coached, and know that these acceptance letters from early action basically give them some wiggle room. That's one of the really nice things about early action. You can get in, get an acceptance, know it early, and then as other acceptances come in, you can basically balance offers against each other, and you can, if needed, you can write to schools and have them know about and match, or at least match partially, other schools' acceptance and financial offers.
You raise a great point because I think many students and families don't realize that there is some negotiation that can happen. But as I've learned from admissions, you have to get in touch sooner rather than later, or there's not going to be much that they can do. So as soon as you know, especially if it is an early action one and it is someplace you really, really do want to go, do get on that phone call with the financial aid office to see what you can do.
Absolutely. You bring up one thing, and I think it tends to be more true every year, and that's the earlier you can get information to schools, the earlier they can let you know whether they're interested, and the earlier you can start applying for things like money and scholarships and that. And one of the things that I keep telling students and families now is colleges have X amount of money that they're usually dealing with, a budget, each year. And if you are early in the process, your chances of getting money is much better at the beginning when they have it than at the end when they don't. Because if they've given away the money and you're coming to the table late, your chances just aren't as good.
That's true. The other thing I would say is, you know, in addition to the money aspect, and, you know, definitely check out, I think, our podcast on going to college on OPM, Other People's Money. You can check out that episode. But I think the other thing you have to think about is usually there's additional steps required. And one of them that, you know, is coming up is the mid-year report or the mid-year transcript. Yep. So for some schools, whether it be early decision or early action, especially if you're early decision, I tell my students, don't, you know, start lazing off or think, you know, doing other things, because they will need that final transcript. And some schools also require mid-year report to show that you're not suffering from senioritis.
Exactly. And I think that's one thing that that students also need to be very aware of. The pressure is still on, especially if you have scholarships that are in the motion, and also if you've got schools that you're still trying to get into. You know, those first sets of grades, other accolades and notable recognitions from the school, all of those things, you can update schools that are still trying to figure out whether you are going to be accepted or not. So, you know, it's not time to let down the guard, for sure.
Definitely not. And especially if schools like your early decision schools that are requesting a mid-year report, and that you also have to check with your high school on, because what I realized is some high schools, it's actually just part of the process that they automatically send the mid-year report to all the colleges. Yep. And some schools are, you just have to request them. But the thing I would say about that is, even if a college does not request your mid-year report, you know, don't think that you can slack off in the middle. I think it's even more important that you hold on to your grades and improve upon them, because there is no hard cutoff for, you know, a rescindence, right?
Yep, exactly.
So you don't want to get to the end of your senior year and then they say, oh, you did not meet our expectations, and regrettably, we have to take back our acceptance. So, you know, even if a school doesn't require a mid-year, you still should press on getting the best grades you can.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where you can point to an outstanding academic record that, you know, is consistent over a long period of time, or goes up as you get through your high school career. And those are things that actually weigh in later when you're asking for or applying to different things like internships and for scholarships, maybe even in your college career. So it actually, it's not time to get to ease up, should we say.
Yes. What else should they be on the lookout for in terms of action items in this package they get?
Yeah, that the other stuff that you're going to see, everything from you'll get, you know, a couple of things that identify what to do for housing and our favorite, you know, meal plans and anything having to do with food we would like to talk about. Also the other things that they'll see are things like possible lab fees and that kind of thing, if they know that you're headed in a particular direction in your academic career. They'll identify those things. A lot of times the housing one is definitely something you want to pay attention to, because that is not something you want to show up to and not have done.
That's true. And I remember colleges always say it's first come, first serve, right? So especially if a college cannot guarantee a dorm, or if there's certain accommodations you would like, definitely, again, like we said before, the sooner the better, in letting them know that. And I would also say, you know, if there's additional papers and documents required in addition to the final academic transcript, make sure you do get those to the schools. I know that very rarely do they take back an acceptance because of that. But if you recall last year, the UC Irvine situation, they ended up canceling a lot of acceptances and then taking it back, thankfully. But just because certain people had not sent in their final transcripts or it had not been received. So follow up if you need to with the colleges to make sure they have everything they need from you.
Exactly. And one of the things that I was at a conference last year, and they had admissions representatives from DU or University of Denver, and one from, I can't remember the other school, and they both had accepted, they realized that they had accepted more freshmen than they actually had spots for in the dormitory. And it was, you know, a couple hundred students. Mm. And at that point, I think students really want to know that they've already sent in all the information that the schools requested so that they have a spot. Cause you don't want to be one of those students that's been accepted and this college is actually trying to figure out where you're going to stay.
Yes. And I know I have heard from other schools in New England where that's happened in the past and they had to just rent out hotels, but you don't want to be missing campus life. Although I'm sure it is very convenient living in a hotel.
Yeah, man. Especially if you're living in a hotel and they're coming cleaning your room, that would be something special.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, because I've had parents come to me and they don't understand their financial package.
Yep.
Not getting into how you get more money this time, but really understanding what makes up those different lines.
Well, yeah. This is the time that you know, we go back to talking about things that we've talked about in other podcasts, but this is a great time to revisit what the actual, you know, what is called the COA or cost of attendance. But at this point in the game, you don't want to know the cost of attendance of the school necessarily. You want to know the actual cost of attendance. And how do you run over those actual cost of attendance with your students?
So we do break it down, and some colleges are better at this than others, I will say, in terms of, you know, adding up everything: tuition, miscellaneous fees, room and board, books and supplies, travel, additional expenses, right? And then I even tell them to add on a little bit of buffer on top of that.
Absolutely.
Because you usually overspend, I think, in college. And then afterwards, so then you try to figure out, how much can my family actually pay, which is the EFC, estimated family contribution. And then you take a look at, you know, the types of, hopefully you've received some kind of money, what kind of money you've received. And is it money that you get to not pay back or money that you will have to pay back? And then sometimes there's something called the gap. And we're not talking about the clothing store, but the difference between what your family can pay and what the school has offered in the package.
Exactly. That gap, I think, is the one that is probably the most important number of all. And basically, if you think of the gap as the distance between what kind of fundings are coming from other sources, how much the school's going to cost, and basically that gap represents no man's land. It's something that a financial gap that hasn't been covered. And the larger the gap, the less happy you should be.
Correct. And I feel like I've had many a parent come in and not understand that the school has gapped them.
Right.
And then the question then becomes, what do you do?
Yep.
Where do you go from there?
What are the most common places where I think students need to know that money is available from a number of different resources, some of them local, some of them, you know, nationally. But a lot of times, you know, and this is why I really encourage students to identify scholarships that they are going to be very competitive for, because those scholarships can basically be the main source of closing that gap.
Yes, that is true. We do have to be wary of that, though, because you're supposed to also report your scholarships.
Yeah.
So then it can also eat into some of that. But I think at the same time, also looking at the different types, right? And also understanding, is it a one-time offer, or will it, you know, will you get it every year?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it's you know, $5,000 for the first year, then that's $5,000 that will be basically a gap for years 2 through 4 or longer. And that's an important thing to note. Like you say, if it's not identified as a 4-year recurring gift, you have to figure out ways that you're going to make that up in years 2 through 4.
Yes. And if it is a recurring gift, I think the thing you have to understand is usually there is some catch.
Mm-hmm. What kind of what are the most common catches include? Of course, you know, keeping your colleges want to make sure that you're showing up to class and doing well. So I know it's very common for almost all kinds of awards. They want to know what your GPA is, and that you have to provide evidence that you've been showing up and doing well.
Yes. That is correct. And then there's also some where you might get an invitation to like an honors program of sorts, which then also has some additional requirements, whether it be additional courses or projects or papers that you have to take on as well.
Yeah. What are the most common, I've seen some written exercises that basically identify, they're basically designed so that they can have a student identify what their growth and what they're doing in college and how that has been a good, it's been a good investment by who has provided them with the opportunity for decreased debt. And I think that's one of the things that I've seen a lot of organizations who provide scholarships, they want to stay in touch and they want to hear how you were developing.
That is absolutely true. I remember when I was in school, they would actually gather the, if anyone received merit, or, well, not, I shouldn't say merit, I should say gifts, right? Gift aid. That you, there would be, they would have special events just so donors could meet these students, in addition to having us write letters thanking them and updating them on what we're doing with our education.
Yeah, one of those mixers, or as it is with donors, I think students really need to know. That is not only an incredible opportunity for them to meet their benefactors, but it's also a wonderful networking opportunity, as well as it's part of the pay it forward, because if you are showing donors that their investment is being very well used, you are basically providing students who come after you with a positive light. And I think donors are much more willing to provide more funding the next year.
Correct.
They talk to kids who are making the most of the opportunity.
That is absolutely correct. And then they do use some of that for marketing also to their alumni to get more money. So, you know, they're all tied together.
Absolutely.
But now how should parents decide or families decide if they have been gapped? What do you do next?
Well, I mean, after they've been gapped, it's basically you work through the possible routes of closing that gap and identifying what are the, I mean, this is the time you have a conversation about if you are taking on external loans. You're talking about that wonderful thing called compound interest.
Yes.
That is going to accumulate, which is the one that no student really wants to have a large compounding interest debt at the end of 4 years, because that really is something that changes your immediate lifestyle as soon as you graduate. So one of the things is to talk about what is compound debt and what kind of things you can do to minimize it. What are the things that you work with families on decreasing that gap?
I think sometimes we do have that conversation in terms of, are there additional scholarships? Some students will say, oh, I also have federal work study. That doesn't help towards the gap. It doesn't even really count, in my opinion, towards financial aid. Yep. Because it's more like pocket money. But I think, unfortunately, some other conversations we need to have are, is this still the best fit school for you?
Yep.
Because so, it's a hard conversation to have if it's your dream school, but you can't afford it.
I'm curious, when you have students who they get, you know, let's say that the unicorn has visited them this season and they have got acceptance letters from their, you know, their top five schools. And now they're sitting down and they are basically identifying, like you say, what is the gap, if any? Maybe they have very small gaps in all of them. But what are the things that you tell students as they sit with those letters in front of them? They're identifying the gap. What are the things that you have them consider when they're making their final selections?
I have them consider ROI in terms of, well, if you do take on this gap in the form of debt, how quickly will you be able to pay it off in the chosen academic interest and professional endeavor that you are thinking you will do right now? And then we have a talk also about whether it's worth it. So sometimes a gap might not be worth it for undergrad if you're considering graduate school. And in other situations, if you want to come out and you don't want, or I guess, what are the benefits of coming out debt-free? So there are situations that you might be faced with which are difficult, where you might have to pay a lot for one school that you really want to go to. But let's say your home state university is almost giving you a free ride and you don't feel like, but you don't think you're going to be academically challenged. So it's trying to find, weigh those pros and cons, right? So I think when you tell a kid compound interest, they don't quite get it. But when you tell them, hey, do you want to be living with your parents when you get out of school because you have a lot of debt to pay off? And unfortunately, that is what is happening right now. It's called the boomerang generation for a reason. They're boomeranging back to their parents. Or do you want to be able to buy your own car one day or your own home or things like that? Because some of that, you know, goes away when you take on additional debt. And I think in that sense, students start to think a little more differently about their dream school if they got gapped.
Exactly. I think you using the tangible visual illustration of what taking on debt actually looks like is one of the more powerful ways, because when you talk about numbers and compound interest, it just becomes a number. And I think when you say you're $150,000 in debt, it in the back of your mind, that's not tangible to anything. But if you say, okay, if you're $150,000 in debt and you're going into a job that for the first 5 years, you're not going to make over $70,000, your ability to pay on that debt and knock it down is going to be very limited versus the amount of debt that's accruing. And that's when compound interest comes back to haunt you. So I think that's like you say, if you tell a student, so how do you feel about graduating with a debt that means that your social life will be a movie once a month, and that going out to dinner is something that you're only going to be able to do once every 2 weeks at most? I think when you put those realities on it, I think students are much more open to listening. Have you found that?
Yes. And I think it's interesting because depending on the types of students you work with, if they're blessed enough to have parents who've supported them, a lot of parents usually say, I'm not supporting you after college. And I have to say, you probably like the lifestyle mom and dad have given you, but do you want to have that same lifestyle when you graduate, or are you going to be okay living on a lot less?
Exactly. And I think that's probably the one thing I use kind of as a benchmark. I don't know if you use a similar one, but I tell students it's related to the ROI. Return on investment is basically that point of what kind of earning power are you going to be able to have, and what is its relationship to the debt that you are going to accumulate. And basically, if you are studying in a major, that when you graduate, you are worth $100,000. That's great, but if you're going to be more than $100,000 in debt, that's just silly. And it's even more silly if you go to, say, like Harvard, and you're going to have $150,000 debt when you graduate, and you're going into teaching. Basically, that's not a really good use of your finances, especially when you graduate, and there are a lot of zeros staring you in the face.
That's true. And I even use my own personal example, how I got into my dream school, but for financial reasons could not attend. And it all worked out just fine. And so another thing I think we talk about is, are there multiple routes to get to the same destination? So if your goal is this, can another school also help you get there and you be happy there?
Yeah, that's the main thing is, are you going to get an education that sets you up for success in the future? And success in the future should also, you know, you should be cognizant of the debt that you're going to accumulate. And basically, if you can get a very similar education in two places, and one of them costs twice as much, I don't know. How do you justify making that kind of a choice if you're going to have a long-term debt that's going to chase you for you know, many years?
That's true. So we have talked a lot about the finances. What else is important with this offer letter?
Well, I think the main thing to do, be aware and be very conscious of deadlines. In that letter, you will see things that say you need to, you know, you need to contact, or you need to send, or you need to write these things by this date. And that's one thing I think that can sideline a lot of people who are especially early action. If you've got a couple of schools that have accepted you, you need to know that if you are expected to have certain information to the school, well, if you didn't do that and they aren't saving you a spot and you're counting on it, it's a very bad day when you find out, oh, that offer's gone.
That's a great point. So I think we've covered a lot of great things in terms of what's really important. So what is one thing you think is most important if they've been accepted early action?
Read the letter fully and look at deadlines. That's the main one. So basically make a checklist. You can even make it on the back of the letter and say, you know, these are the things I have to attend to for this particular school, and make sure that you know if there's any little things that are hidden.
That's a great point. And do read it thoroughly. And if you feel like you are reading it and some things don't make sense, don't be afraid to call the school.
Absolutely.
Get clarification.
That's one thing I made a mention to you. I think I have a favorite song by Tom Waits, and it's called Step Right Up. And one of the lines in the song is, "The small print taketh what the big print giveth away." And I think, or let's see, how did I have that? I remember when I wrote it down that it was basically the association with acceptance letters really similar. And oh, it's this: the small print taketh what the big print giveth. And I think that's one thing that you need, like you said, read the letter thoroughly.
Yes. And I think some other things, let's have a discussion about our students in real cases, right? So in terms of, we talked about appealing a financial aid package. And I think there's a few things to keep in mind. Maybe you have some better case studies, but if you are appealing a financial aid letter, first of all, make sure you're calling the financial aid office and not the admissions office. Secondly, make sure you have support for why you want it appealed in terms of related to your financial circumstance. Is there something that wasn't considered? But make sure you have that supporting information for when you contact them. What are some additional things you think that they should also keep in mind?
Sure. I think students have to remember that a human is on the other side reading this, and you have to make a case that basically instills empathy and that they can acknowledge that there is a true and authentic need that you have. And like you say, it's supported with examples and numbers that show that it would be a hardship for you to attend the university with the amount of financial aid that they're offering. And in some cases, if you don't make that clear and make that a very obvious choice, you won't receive much in return.
That's true. And I think also if you're doing negotiations, Mark, you had mentioned it before, but using other letters that have perhaps offered you a more generous package can be used as leverage. It has to be done tastefully, but it can be done. And, you know, I think the other thing you want to think about is this, I think, is especially important for first generation students because they might not have access to as many resources or know as much. But sometimes if you let your teachers know or your guidance counselor, but other people might be able to advocate for you too. And say, because I know I've had people in high school who have reached out to colleges and say, you know, you have to take this girl. This school is giving them this. She would be amazing and blah, 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 blah. But obviously it has to be someone that you have a really close relationship with that would be willing to also try and advocate for you.
For sure. That's one of those situations where you realize making relationships with people, long-term relationships with people, pay off in ways that you can't imagine. And this is one of those cases where if a school is allowing you additional letters of recommendation and support, if you've got people who are willing to step up and say, these are the specific reasons why this student is a good bet. It's somebody that is going to do exceptional things, and here's why. That letter actually, I don't think students realize, can actually make a difference.
Yes, it really can.
When you have you ever seen in a letter where there's a common mistake in reading it? When a family sits down and they read through it, and when they contact you and they say, and they're basically describing what the letter has, their interpretation is different than what it really is. What's a common mistake in acceptance letters?
I think it is not seeing the gap. So I've had many families, unfortunately, say that or had admissions tell them, oh, we're giving them this money, and they don't realize that sometimes it's not all at once. So like I said, it's split up over 4 years, or that they're getting gapped and they're not understanding, wait, but my need is this, but the school gave me that. And they don't necessarily understand, well, what happened to the rest? And that they don't realize it's really on them, you know, the families, to really reconcile that gap. It's not necessarily the responsibility of the university to do that.
Exactly. Where's the rest? That's the most common thing that I think often is not maybe misinterpreted, but missed, is there's that gap and how that gap actually gets closed, and realizing that it's basically a family's responsibility at that point. And that's one thing I think that is common. The worst thing the most common thing I think that scares me is when somebody says they have a full ride. And as you read through the letter, you realize, you know, definition of full ride is not always accepted the same way by all sources.
That is a great point, because I've had students who've also said they got a full ride, but they don't realize it's only covering tuition.
Yes. Yes. The tuition is paid for. I will be sleeping on the streets and eating, tofu. Yes.
And I think with that, I think we should, I think this will be a fun thing to end on, but what is the most number of schools you've had a student get accepted to? And do you think it was a blessing or a curse?
Well, this is one of those classics, because I think all academic counselors, those of us who work with students through this application process and acceptance process, it's one of those things, if you've done your due diligence, you shouldn't be applying to 30 schools, because those 30 schools are so different that saying that you're going to a best fit school and all of them are going to serve you the same is ridiculous. So I think the largest number of schools that I've had a student I've worked with who's applied to and got accepted, I think it was probably 21 schools and they got accepted to 16.
Wow, that's quite a number.
And they shouldn't have applied to all those schools. And then they had a headache. They were almost back at square one trying to figure out what are the specific differences between these schools and which one should I choose. So it's a blessing and a curse. How about you?
It's both, yes. I also had a student who, against my better judgment, applied to 20 schools, got into about half of them. And I think it was hard in the decision making, because they were deciding between a full ride, so really, truly a full ride from a great school, a tuition scholarship from one school. So again, that's almost like a half a ride.
Yeah.
And then some schools who didn't give him anything. And I think it was really hard. In the end, he went with a school that gave him nothing, because I think it also had to do with his family as well. But he said, you know, if I were paying, I would just have picked the school that gave me all the money.
Yep.
And like, ironically, my parents are paying and they want to pay full price. So I said, okay, that works. So I think it was a blessing in the sense that he had so many great options to choose from. And I think it was interesting that he was mature enough to identify that if he were going to be paying, which one he would have picked, and that he would have saved himself the money.
Yeah, it's different. It's fun to hear that. And I think there are those students who are actually more cognizant about the money and the finances than their parents at times. And the parents are so hung up on boutique or name brand schools.
Correct.
That they're willing to, you know, make this incredibly large financial payment versus having, you know, somebody pay for all the finances related to going to college for their child. And I think that's one of those tough things. It's everybody makes their own choice.
That's true. And you can't necessarily, I think you have to pick what's best. And still in this situation, he chose the school that was the best fit for him.
Yep.
When you disregarded the finances involved. So, you know, I think for every family, it's going to be a little different. And I think you have to take the priorities of not only the student, but your family as well into account as you guys make these decisions.
Agreed. Yeah, I love it when students can go to a school on other people's money and completely focus on college and what's in front of them and their academics and their next steps rather than the money that they're accumulating as a debt. But sometimes maybe they have different view.
Yes. So let's really quick recap what is most important when you get these offer letters. First, check. Did you get a decision? And what is that decision?
Number two, read the full letter.
Yes. And in detail. Three, understand the deadline, date commitments, in terms of what documents are due when.
Absolutely. And number four, understand what that gap is and make sure you understand how you're going to cover it.
And lastly, I would just say, remember, National College Decision Day is May 1st. And in most situations, unless you're accepted early decision, you will have until May 1st to decide. So do not feel pressured to pull the trigger prematurely if you need some time to make that decision.
Agreed. And after May 1st, you can take a big breath.
And a vacation if you can.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
You bet. And good luck to all those students who are out there waiting for their golden ticket.
Yes, we wish you the best.
Thanks for listening to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast, where we make getting into college easy and fun. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and subscribe to get updated each week when we release a new episode. Also, for more helpful college admissions information, visit our website at www.c2ccollegepodcast.com.